Well, the narrative. And one or two questions have been raised about the extent of it and how far it should be taken. And some have been finding frustration when carrying a narrative to an extreme, as if this frustration should not occur. Whereas in actual fact, this frustration is an essential part of the work. Because if you don't get frustrated, you haven't really completed the analysis. Let's draw a circle and say this circle represents the bound of conceptual activity, that is intellectual activity. Beyond this circle is the abyssal no form, which, if we remember, is the same thing as the absolute will. When the spirit comes in, rotates, it produces the sphere of being, and this sphere, in its largest sense, is the cosmic soul, the soul of the world. In the act of coming in, the spirit, which is free prior to its rotation, becomes bound, and in the binding, it does two things. It finds itself in objective existence, and at the same time it loses the free motion that it had prior to rotating. So it has a positive aspect, which we'll represent by the sign of the positive, the cross, the orange cross, and it has a negative aspect, namely it has lost the free motion of the absolute in the process of objectifying itself. It is gaining objectivity, it is losing absolute motion. The absolute pure motion is a motion, as we've said before, or translation. It just keeps moving and it never turns back upon itself and meets itself. The pure motion of translation we can demonstrate in a tank, only subject to remembering the tank has sides and the motion is impeded by being reflected from the sides. But if we imagine an infinite ocean, an ocean with no shores, and ripples going through this ocean in all directions simultaneously, so that there is an infinite passing of motion through this infinite continuum, and none of it rotates, yet a very peculiar thing happens, that the appearance of rotation arises at the intersection points of the translating motions. If I draw a line to represent a wave front, which is travelling from the left of the paper to the right, if I draw another one at right angles to this, travelling from the top down, as this one advances from left to right and this one from top below, we get an apparent movement of the intersection point. Now the intersection point of two forces is always the generation of a rotation or vortex. So when we have two translating waves intersecting, at the intersection points we have an apparent creation of a sphere of rotation. In the very tiniest sphere, we could say we have the prime particle of the material world. But it has no validity from itself. Its validity is only that of a product of something beyond itself. The free motion translating at right angles to another motion produces the intersection point, which travels all the time, apparently, although this travelling of the intersection point is not, in fact, a truth. It is an appearance. The reality is the translating motion. The appearance is the travelling of the intersection, which bisects the angle between the two waves. In this sense, we could say that the material world is at right angles to the spiritual world. In the sense, the material world is bisecting motions in the spirit, pure motions. And at the intersection points of these translating motions, there arises the appearance of zones of spin, or spheres of being, prime particles, and then complexes of these, building up to atoms, molecules, and so on, till we have a complex being like a human being. Now, if we look at this motion of translation here, which I've kept very simple by using only two motions, one at right angles to the other, we see that the translating motions present us with the appearance of a grid. And if we become identified with the wave crests without travelling, we will see this grid very clearly. If you get a square bowl, one of the plastic bowls that you can buy just quite well for this, and strike it with a stick on one side, the stick being parallel with the side, so you give the impact along the whole length, a straight wave will pass across the water, hit the other side, and be reflected back. If while this is travelling, you hit the other side at right angles to it, you will see a grid of waves crossing each other. There's an old Indian saying that says, when the surface of the sea is rough, one cannot see the bottom, and that the mind is exactly like this. If you get a boat with a glass bottom in it, let's draw one, here's a boat, and there's the surface of the water. There may be waves beyond the boat and round the boat, but the bottom of the boat has no waves because the bottom of the boat is flat glass pressing upon it, so that it kills the motion that would otherwise arise. Now the light of the sun may be shining on the waves and bouncing into the observer's eye, so that he cannot see below the surface. But if he looks inside the boat, to the glass bottom of the boat, because there are no waves, the light cannot bounce into his eye, and he can see straight to the bottom of the boat, to the ground at the bottom of the sea. In fact, it is surprising how deeply we can see in a glass bottom boat, such as certain pearl fishes use. The analogy in the mind is simple. If instead of looking in the outside world and being dazzled by the phenomenal reflection from the objects, if we look inside ourselves, treat the body as the ark, look inside and flatten the surface of the mind as if you had a glass bottom, looking through the mind you will see the ground of being. If we look at our translating motions at right angles to each other, they draw for us a grid. And if we look at this wave crest of the travelling waves, we cannot see through the water. If we look at the intersection points of the waves that are travelling at right angles to each other, we can see phenomenally zones of spin, little vortical activities on the intersections, in the angle between, and these points travelling constitute the phenomenal world, in the analogy of the world of material things. Material things are modes of activity bisecting the angles between spiritual forces. Now let's draw a grid inside our circle for a moment and consider what it does for us. It acts like a screen. When we identify with the wave crests, which tend to catch our attention, because when a wave is made, the forces in the crest building it up are forces in opposition. The mass of water is built up because forces are opposing each other. Consequently, there is an intention at the wave crest which the trough does not have. We can, if we like, write positive on the wave crest and negative in the wave trough. Now, the crest is from kra to create, plus the S for spirit and T for cross. When the forces are crossing each other, spirit creates or locks itself up. Now, in the act of focusing on the crest or that which is created, the attention, the tension of oneself is focused in such a way as to be pinned, to be bound by the form presented in the mind. This causes the formulation of an idea. That's the way every crest is made up of opposing forces, and these forces produce tension. Intention, when viewed as centripetal, extension, viewed as centrifugal, and attention, viewed psychologically as the focal point of consciousness. When we look at the crest, we are finited and our consciousness is full of discrete elements. These discrete elements cut the mind into little bits. The mind cannot have unity while we are thinking. And the clearer the idea, the more clearly formulated it is, the less unity there is in the mind. Now, why then do we wish to analyze if our formulation progressively obscures ultimate reality? And the answer is because halfway is no good. Most people do not analyze, but they suffer from presented forms that they have not yet broken down. And they accept these forms as valid. Thus, a person born at a certain social level will tend to be left-wing, and born at another level will tend to be right-wing. He does not analyze the concepts, the forms in his mind, and therefore he is being conditioned by them. Now, when we analyze the concept, we don't do it because we think that this concept will confer power upon us. It is for the exact opposite reason. We analyze or loosen this thing because we know that power is locked up in it. The analysis is merely going to return us to the state we had prior to the intellective activity that generated this form. So that when we analyze a word, we begin to take out the subsidiary crests in the word, which have been crushed together, apparently, in a simple concept. Simple concept like democracy. Let us let this crest represent democracy, and let's start cutting it. And we have on the one side the demos, and on the other side, the classy. One means people and the other means government. So we split this wave up into two waves. Now, the demos to people, meaning knee benders, and the classy part, meaning government, are contradictory ideas. We have taken the energy involved into democracy and cut it into two crests and divided the energy between them. If we now attack the word demos and see why it means people, we are going to take the single crest representing demos and split it. We'll split it into D and mos. Now D means analysis, so we'll take the energy of this one and split it. And the mos means substantial issue. So the whole word means that which is dividing the substance and causing it to leak. If you like, the word means incontinent, losing power. So we can cut this again into two, and then we will take the D and the mos and separate them and analyze D and A and see that death is the forcing of a way through, the creation of a door in air, in a field. That letter E is the fifth letter, equivalent to the Hebrew He, and means the field of life. And the death is the door. So that we have, as it were, put a hand upon the field and separated it. Again, we split the thing. As we're doing this, this one's high crest is lowering and the energy in it is returning into the field. We can see then that we're beginning to pull down the energy in the original concept and return it to the field. This is the real reason for intellectual analysis. We say break the thing down, not break it up, when we're analyzing. And we break the thing down and we restate the original continuous energy, and we have reduced it from a state of high tension on wave press to a state of equable tension throughout the field. This is equivalent to having a glass bottom to your body belt. You can now see through the substance of the field. Now this substance of the field, as we've said before, is no more than the original sentient power of the Absolute. When that power is travelling along without interruption, it cannot build up a wave crest, and therefore cannot make a depression, a trough. It cannot be elated, it cannot be depressed. If therefore we look through it, what we see in it is nothing. There is no thing, no tension, no attention, no extension. And in so doing, we have regained the free motion of the original essence. But this free motion is not static, because static is a concept derived from forces in opposition, pressing against each other. This pure continuous motion of the Absolute is not static, it is free and it is initiative. It can do anything whatever by free initiative. It can pile up, because it has no inertia, it can pile up immediately and locally a crest, if it so wills. And it has no inertia, so it can get rid of it again. Whereas in the case of the water that is full of waves, the intention of the crest and the extension or distension in the trough is so much energy bound in, this is inertia, that it takes a considerable amount of energy to cancel it and reduce it to the flat. So if there has been a storm at sea and you go to it with a very large piece of perspex, specially purchased for the purpose, and you bang it on the surface of the sea to stop the motion, you'll find there's an awful lot of motion in the sea. And if, having pressed it quite flat, you pick up your sheet of perspex again, which we will assume to be as big as the Atlantic Ocean, and as you lift it up, all the waves start up again. Because the motion you have pressed down has not stopped. It has merely been pressed into the water as a substance. So that if you don't leave it time to die down, that is to equilibrate and reach maximum entropy, it will start up again. This is the thing that Jesus is talking about when he talks about a man who swept his house clean after turfing a devil out, and having got the house clean, he went away. And when he came back, that devil had returned with seven others worse than himself. This is what happens to a man who thinks, I will meditate and clear my mind of rubbish, and because I believe that it's possible to do it, I will do it with great effort now. And he sits down, and with super effort he calms his mind until it's perfectly clear, and then he says, good, my mind is now clear, I have the mind of a yogi, I can see right into the depth of being, so now I will take a girl to the pictures. And he then gets up and goes out. And immediately, all the things he flattened jump up again. because he has gone out, and because he did not leave time for maximum entropy to set in inside his substance. He has tried to do a job immediately and now with a super effort, and he's used up all his finite power to do it. He has attained this clarity. Many men who do this get an immediate apprehension of reality that shocks them and convinces them that there is such a thing as ultimate reality, and that it's worth having, and the shock of seeing it is so great they stop doing it. And then when they try to do it again, they find they haven't got enough energy to do it. And then a kind of rationalizing process comes in to them and takes over for a long period of time, and they may in fact not see that experience again for years. But they will always remember that it was a valid experience of transcendence at that moment. If you remember Humphrey Davy and the laughing gas experiment, where he inhaled some nitrous oxide, and then instead of seeing students sitting in their seats, he saw a little vortices spinning. He never again believed that there were such things as students. He just saw everybody as a vortex spinning in a field of energy. But he did not develop the power deliberately and freely to see them again in that same way. He'd had his experience that profoundly conditioned his view of reality, but he did not develop the power to see it this way at will. Therefore, when we take any given term, the more abstract the term is, the more subject that term is to analysis, and the greater the amount of power in it. If you take the term Nellie Dean and break it down, you will find there's less in it than there is in the word absolute, if you confine it to the original meaning of Nellie Dean. But if you break Nellie down and Dean down, you'll find it starts dissolving back into the absolute. And if you take any so-called abstract term, and we can look at the word abstract in two different ways, you know, the abstract part means drawing. Trinary is a drawing, and the ab means father, and this has its own issue, spiritual issue, from the father. Father, energy coming forth, drawing things and passing them on the cross. An abstract idea is very near God the Father. So if you take an abstract idea like philosophy and break it down into the philo and the sophy part, you discover one means love and the other means wisdom. So you take your central precipitating crest and you take the energy involved in it and you break it into two crests. It is no longer as high as it was. It is now wider than it was. And then you take the philos part of it and cut that. And you see basically there's a pi and a la there, or a pi law, and you put P on the one side and L on the other, and you split this and it comes lower still. You do the same thing with the so and the phi on the other side, and you discover that the love here referred to is no more than the positing of a link, and say a means whereby a connection is seen. Every time you split a term, if I take the letter P and split that, I split it into consonantal P and vowel F. And I again cut down the height of the wave, and I'm gradually returning the energy that was involved in the word philosophy back into the field. In the process, I'm discovering that philosophy really is no more than a fundamental notion of a sphere of being with motions traversing it backwards and forwards and crossing each other, so that any given wave may be considered as positive to the others and acting in the role of male or analytical force, and the other is acting as female or receptive force. So that we can say that every existential term, every word we can utter, insofar as it exists, and stimulates the ear has in it involved a definite amount of energy, and we can gain this energy by cutting the word into its constituent parts. Now we come to a zone fairly low down where we begin to wonder how the devil we're going to cut P. This is the zone of frustration. Now frustration itself tells you by the word that there is a fire in it, there is a use in it, there is a law in it, there is crucifixion in it, and there is a zone of motion. When you feel this frustration, you're not getting any further with your analysis, you are getting overheated. The heat you experience is exactly the same thing when gathered together as willpower and initiative. So that if you don't work to the point of frustration, you will not discover the energy in the concept. If you do work to the point of frustration, and you have the controlled concept in your mind that the heat of this frustration is no more than the heat of energy willing something, you can switch over from the concept through the frustration into pure will. So that people who are never frustrated just haven't worked. And people who are frustrated and think they shouldn't be and give it up have been fooled by the grid that is placed over the sphere of their being. Now in a church you have a screen. This screen separates the church. Beyond the part where the people are, there is a mysterious part where strange things go on. The purpose of this screen, profanely, is to simply divide things holy from things not holy, the people from God. But this screen represents no more than the surface lights catching the ripples on your being and diverting you from seeing into the depth, the reality of being. So the chancel screen, as the word tells you, it's a singing thing, it's a method of diverting, it's the lorelei causing the sailor to go on the rocks. When you see that screen, you should say that screen means we must dazzle the people so that they cannot see the basic propositions behind reality. Now what are they when we come to examine it? There is no pontiff or monarch or scientist that will not confess that on the one side there is force and on the other side form, matter. That this force is acting upon this matter. And there's nothing else. If we complete our triangle, we can write inside the triangle sentient power. S and P. Subject and predicate. There isn't anything else. When you are asked to bend the knee to something, you are asked to do so by some subject who understands that you are a member of the people. If you bend the knee, he makes a formal statement. If the sparkle of the statement catches your gaze so you can't see through to his deep intent, that's your business and you will bend the knee. If you see through the phenomenal sparkle to the intent of the will below, you will not bend the knee. But then you won't be a P, you'll be an S. Every person is essentially a subject, that is a spiritual being. Now the two forms of S, yeah, the open S, which is eternal S in the Greek, and the initial and medial S, which is a closed one. The initial medial one begins a word, and the other one, the open one, ends a word. Why is that so? Because when you begin, you bang. You It's also a medial, that is a continuing yes. And therefore you represent it with the divine serpent with tail in mouth. So at the end of the word, it takes its tail out of its mouth and frees itself from the formulation that it started. In the beginning, there is binding. In the middle, there is binding. And at the end, there is loosing. If we know this, we can see that only the free serpent is truly itself and unduped by the formal behavior arising from closing or biting one's own tail. Michelangelo's mason's mark is simply three circles laced together. If you get a pair of compasses and try this yourself, you discover that you can repeat this to infinity if you've got that much time, paper and patience. This simple interlacing of circles can give rise to the whole phenomenal world in all its relations. Without stopping, you can run round from one circle to another to infinity. This closed circle, this serpent with tail in mouth, is the most economic way of saying one element in the chain mesh, the armor of God, the thing that he keeps you out from, pure will. That's simple. The means whereby free spirit objectifies itself is by closure, by rotation. And this rotation is a bind. It's a filter and a screen and stops you seeing that you are concerned entirely with free will, possessing objects which are bound. Now, in the Hebrew, there's a funny letter, and this letter is shaped like a trident. In the Tarot, his name is Forka, the fork, and it is equated with the fool. This letter is made of three other letters, and the letters they're made of are simply the same letter repeated three times. It is the sixth letter of the alphabet. So if you put down this number six three times in English notation, it's 666. It is the number of a man and the number of the beast in Revelation. Whether it's the number of the man or of the beast depends on how you look at it. If you wish to humanize yourself, you can see it as the number of man, the evaluator. If you see it as the beast, you see it as a closed system of energies, no longer aware of the fact that they are self-precipitated. The beast is the energy involved become inert. He can't get out of his pattern. The man aspect of it is evaluated. And the Hebrew letter, you can put a dot either over the sinister tooth of the trident or over the dexter tooth. And if you put it on the sinister side, it is pronounced shin. And if you put it on the dexter side, it is pronounced sin. Shin means the eternal spirit, and sin means the temporal spirit or matter. There is a joke about this, namely that all there is in the universe is just this purka, this trident. And the sin is only the shin precipitated. The shin is the absolute fire of God. This letter shin means fire. The Hebrew word for a man is yod shin, ish. Means fire, it's the noise that fire makes on the preconditions, you know. And man is a fire, or man is a spirit. And if you point him on the absolute consciousness side, then he is spread out. He says, he takes out the crest of the conceptualized energies and breaks it down to the flat. the sound made by the tongue held flat in that way is sh. But if you allow the dress to go up, put the tip of your tongue against the palate and hold it tight, with a small area in contact, it says sharp S. So that if we like to represent the passage from spirit into matter, we can do so by drawing an arrow through that one letter. The arrow says we are going from shin to sin, from shine to sign, and the genit sig. When you're doing this, your intelligence, your illumination, your shine is becoming signatured or objectified. But there is no objectification other than the self-objectification of the shin by actualization, by self-opposition, pressure against one's self-objectifies. So when the field notions press against themselves in opposition, they produce a zone of sig, or relative ignorance, spirit ig. It is only by condensation of oneself, pressing upon oneself as a sentient power, that any object comes to be. In this sense, every sig that exists, that is every spiritual individuated earth being, is self-precipitated, and the cause of its own objectification, its own destiny, its own reward, and its own punishment. I am my own executioner, says the poet, mystic, and he means my spirit has precipitated my sign. We are all self-condemned, and nothing condemns us except the mode of our own self-conceptualizing. If we take the same joke out of Indian philosophy, we get Shiva Vishava. This is nearly the same word, but not quite. There's a vowel shift. Shiva is the great god with the power of concentration, and Shava means a corpse. So Shiva is like shin, and Shava is like sin. Insofar as you have a corporeal form, mass inertia, you are self-objectified, self-rewarded, self-punished. Now the peculiar thing is that if you don't objectify at all, you feel yourself as a potential of objectification, which is not self-realized. So you feel dissatisfied. And this tends to make you move into objectification. But if you do move into objectification beyond a certain threshold level, you lose awareness of the fact that you are precipitating it, and you become imposed on by your own self-objectification, and you begin to conceive that the form of your being is something that you cannot get rid of, something that is essentially you, and therefore something you're stuck with. Now, in Christian theology, it is the duty of the devil to convict you of sin. Now, convict means convince mightily. Any stimulus that acts upon you to convict you, that is to convince you that the form you have is essential to you and cannot be got rid of, is a devil to you. Factually, there is no form whatever inside you that you have not yourself precipitated. True that you precipitated it in response to a stimulus, but you have precipitated it. The stimulus cannot do it without your help. Imagine yourself as a closed system. You have nothing in you. The stimulus comes and hits you, and the ripple passes through you. But what you do with the ripple as it comes in is your business. If you were transparent to the stimulus, it would go straight through you and be as if it had never been. But If you have started to conceptualize yourself as a finite being, when the stimulus hits you, you go to meet it. This is in the I Ching, this is one of the trigrams called going to meet. When you go to meet it, you are trying to hold it. Maybe you're trying to hold it out because you believe it's even, or you're trying to hold it in because you believe it's desirable. But you are trying to hold it. And in the act of holding the energy of the stimulus, the thing spins. You have now generated a seventh, a subsidiary zone characterized formally by the motion of the stimulus plus the motion of your reaction. You now have what you call a character. This character is very closely related to your concept of the kind of vehicle you have, which is a chariot. The child in the character and the chariot are intimately related. They are both half of power differentiations. Once you have these reactions inside yourself, you're in very, very great danger, because if you're not careful, you will start substantiating them because you believe they are essential parts of your equilibrium. So that if somebody comes along and gives you a stimulus, say, you know the reaction you made to that stimulus number one, I think it was a very bad reaction. Instead of confessing, yay, it was a bad reaction, the tendency is to substantiate it and try to justify this reaction, and therefore to pay more to it to try to build it up. You take the energy of the accusation and you use it to bolster up the already faulty reaction you have shown. You are now building yourself a bad character. Bad means that your house is being divided. So that whenever you indulge in self-defense in the presence of an accusation, you are actually conditioning your body to respond in a progressively more finite, more limited way. The statement in the Tao Te Ching that we should be transparent to the world situation means just this. If we can stop the bounce we feel inside us when a stimulus comes, the energy of the stimulus will go straight through us. We will be aware of what has gone through, but we will not formulate from it and establish in our being an inert form that can condition our behavior. We continuously get rid of the stimulus information. We continue to therefore restate our pralaya, our primary entropy. We get rid of all the characterizing agents. We continuously restate our absolute essential foolishness. We don't know what it is we've been subject to. And every time the stimulus comes to us, instead of building up around the stimulus, we just straighten out again. We go through life flattening ourselves instead of building ourselves. And instead of finishing up as a series of wonderful crests and mountain ranges, we are still flat. Except there's a very peculiar thing about the nature of this flatness. This flatness is the original motion of the absolute. And this motion of the absolute, being absolute, is motion in all directions and contains, therefore, within its all directionalness, in the intersections of this absolute motion, all conceivable forms that may be superstressed in a reactive situation. So that when you restate your flatness, you are not ignorant. You are merely innocent. You can see the form of the situation presented to you, and you see the context in which it belongs. And if you see the absolute field, charged with form, which is the sophic sphere, the wisdom sphere, and as the stimulus hits it, you see to where the stimulus belongs, you see the tendency within the sphere to hold on to it and react, and you level it out again, but you are aware of the zone that responded. So that you continuously restate omniscience when you flatten yourself out. Well, you do not become ignorant.
But if you allow yourself to respond to the stimulus
by building up a resistance to it, or by trying to hold it, to possess it, you superthreat the socket sphere, and then all the forms within the grid are free, and the stimulus comes and perhaps stimulates one of them. If you try to hold the form of the stimulus, you have superstressed part of the grid. Now, if you stress that very, very much, that part of the grid will begin to dominate the field of consciousness. That means that you are now finite, you are now ignorant. And you will respond finitely and therefore erroneously. We see then that the purpose of analysis is loosening. The list in analysis means loosening. The ana part of it is the same thing as motion. We want to get rid of that which binds to motion. The pure motion of the absolute is omniscience itself. But the interfered with superstress motion is zones of relative ignorance. We have to get rid of these by simply refusing to react to the stimulus, although we are very alert as the stimulus is presented and goes through us. We do not allow the reaction. We're not asleep, we're not ignoring the stimulus. We are alert, all work to the stimulus, and the work is to let it through. And you see it as it goes through. And in the process, you are learning all the time about the nature of your own being, without becoming superstressed in the process. Analysis, therefore, is merely a method of attaining frustration, so that when you are fully frustrated, you can say, this is frustration. You can actually feel the limit of frustration, and say, now if I cut again, I do not get a further form, I get nothing, only my own will. And this is precisely what you want, liberation from the conceptualized energies which were built up into wave crest, and the restatement of the original optimal entropy of your own being, which is the same as free initiative. Anything particularly we could focus on at this point?
Is it true that the Russians, as a nation, the Russian soul, sees life in the process, the ever process? There is a plan.
Well, we would expect any people living in flat terrain to see things simply. And as the soul is essentially simple, we will expect to stress on the soul in it. If we get into a terrain that is chopped with sharp mountains, the continuous stimuli of the mountains is forcing the psyche to formulate. And consequently, we wouldn't expect a simple soul in a highly complex environment. This is where the psyche has responded to the stimulus situation. But there is no virtue in the soul that is plain unless it knows that it is plain. So we have to take that the world soul, all the souls that are, whether they're in mountain or plain zones, and use them all in order to perfect the opposition of these things within us to produce the true plane, which contains the crest and the trough in equilibrium. Which is why you should study a book like The Dawn of Civilization. You should get to know about all the different types of civilization, because they are really manifestations of subsidiary entities within any given individual. So the study of the human race in all its various aspects is the study of one man in his various impulses. And therefore ethnology has a function for the individual self-development. And so there's any other department of human knowledge.
Isn't there a sort of term of frustration? Isn't there a sort of period of suffering in this respect to which, by inertia, human beings are, as it were, limited or devoting themselves? Aren't they hanging on to their resistance pattern for a period?
The human race as a whole,
yes, I mean,
is hanging on to its inertia. And this is another aspect of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time. But also there are individual humans who are ahead of the main group and individuals behind it. And all have their function, the slow ones and the fast ones and the mass in the middle. To discover one's own existential inertias and see whether it's time for the individual to transcend them without waiting for the rest of humanity is the essential for any given individual, so that you're not marching into a place that's not truly your own.
Why does there appear to be such a refusal to define on the parts of the majority of people? The fact that they can get into positions, quite elevated positions, even in the teaching and educational world, and be not even clear of the value of definition.
Well, for one thing, the value in definition is not taught. Certainly not at ordinary educational levels, because it is the key to power. It is part of a screen over reality that the educational system does not aim to release you from your social obligations.
There's no doubt that you can define, and then the feeling which arises is a feeling of power, isn't it? The moment that a form is presented, which is not a form to you at the moment yet.
Really, you're feeling liberated from a misconception. And the energy that previously was identified with the misconception is now yours because it's abandoned the misconception. If we remember that stress is emotional, that identification is emotional charge, and this emotional charge on a finite form is actually a trapping of the willpower, because emotion is life force. And if you can be tricked into valuing any given concept so that you think it's a necessity of your existence, you pile in your emotion into that form, and therefore something that's really infinite, your emotion, your potential of the field, is effectually finited into the situation formally, and therefore it is put in bondage. And then other beings who know the ropes can deal with you as a mechanical formulated entity instead of as a free will.
You'd obviously be terrified of definition in that case, in case it breaks down the form.
All governments must be terrified of true definition, because it would release them from the necessity of being a government. If you examine inside the individual pattern, you will actually discover government, that is, controlling concepts of your life, charged with inertia. So that if you detect that one is no good and should be abandoned, it will fight you for it. And it will cause you, if you're not very careful, to forget what you're talking about. It will actually divert you, so that when you say this concept is untrue and I must throw it away, as you throw it away, it will run away, it will change its form and come back and say, yes, you got rid of that one, here is another one better. But it's really the same one in disguise. And it acts like a subsidiary entity within you. And it must do so because absolutely there is nothing other than sentient power. And the sentient power is self-objectified as the form. So an idea, insofar as it's circumscribed, is a definite amount of sentient power. And when sentient power is circumscribed, it constitutes an entity. So this idea, with the energy involved in it, the emotional charge, will actually fight for its own existence against other ideas. This is basic in the Herbartian educational psychology. Now the idea is actually fight like soldiers. Perhaps it was because he was a German and he saw this. But the ideas are fighting like soldiers to the threshold of consciousness. They're not just empty forms, shapes in their energy. They are forms of energy, and this energy is fundamentally sentient. That it feels itself as alive. It witnesses itself as alive. It makes the case for its own existence against other forms that logically contradict it. So that a man with many concepts is a battlefield, literally, between energies that are inconsistent with each other and struggle to dominate the field. There is nothing inside a man that is not outside. And there is nothing outside that is not inside. Which means you've got inside you Lawrence of Arabia and Allenby saying you're glad he has no responsibility. And then they're all there, and if you can see the outside and you dare to look inside, you'll find the thing you have condemned outside is inside. Only, just as the one outside, if you condemn it openly, will retaliate, so the one on the inside, if you condemn it openly, will retaliate. Therefore, softly, softly, catchy monkey. When you discover an idea is erroneous inside you, your best method of getting at it is obliquely. That is, creep up on it. Find another idea that is presupposed in it and basic to it, but not quite so strong, and dissemble this weaker one. Move away from the strong one and find one related to it that is feeding it and destroy it. As you would with a garrison town, manned and armed, a big outpost around it. You wouldn't try to attack the strongest point first. You'd find a few weak points, and you'd destroy those. And this would weaken the central position. So if you take subsidiary concepts of your pet ideas, the full implications of which you have not seen, but you know that they are somehow connected with your central idea and essential to it. They're not sufficiently aware of the connections to defend themselves adequately, so that you can tear them to bits, analyze them, and destroy them. And then the central idea is weakened. You have to conduct your internal individual development in the same way that Joshua conducted his campaigns. In fact, the book of Joshua is about the internal process of fighting the battles of sons.
And in the centre, you have the great image, which is the God. Mm-hmm.
Self-image.
Yes, self-image. And he's in the dark, which is the image, you see.
He must be. That's the essential of the self-image. He dare not betray his own ground, because it would refute him. But he presents you with the scintillations of his performance. He's got his own herald who blows the trumpet and says how clever he is.